Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
So we're going to look at Parshat Metzora today. We're looking at the laws of the purification of the Metzora. So someone who's been diagnosed with Tzara'at. So you're going to turn to Leviticus 14. Vayedaber Adonai al Moshe lemor. God speaks to Moshe and says, Zot tihiye Torat ha-Metzora. This is to be for you, Torat ha-Metzora, the teaching about the Metzora. But Yom Taharato, on the day that the Metzora is purified. Vehuva el ha-Kohen, so the passive form, and is brought to the priest. So lots of commentary wants to suggest, even if the Metzora doesn't want to go, right? So that's why this is put in the passive. He's dragged to the priest, if necessary. So the priest shall go outside the camp, because remember, that's where the Metzora is, right? The Metzora is outside the camp. So the Kohen goes outside the camp, and here we're getting the same language we got last week, the Ra'aha Kohen, right? The Kohen looks, the Kohen examines by sight. If the priest sees that the leper's been healed of Tzara'at, then the priest shall order two live pure birds, cedarwood, crimson stuff, and hyssop to be brought for the one to be purified. The priest shall order one of the birds slaughtered over fresh water in an earthen vessel, and he shall take the live bird along with the cedarwood, the crimson stuff, and the hyssop, and dip them together with the live bird in the blood of the bird that was slaughtered over the fresh water. He shall then sprinkle it seven times on the one to be purified of the eruption and effect the purification, and he shall set the live bird free in the open country. So we are getting this sprinkling, which is different from how usually are people purified that we studied last week. It doesn't take long for us, does it? Life happens and then we forget. So how do you usually purify from different kinds of being tameh? You go into a mikveh, immersion. Is usually how one is purified. That's not what we have here. So for some reason, Tzara'at communicates a tum'ah that simple immersion, not simple, but I mean, immersion itself does not fix, does not rectify. And so we get this sprinkling action that's happening. And then we have lots of folks who are going to talk a little bit about what that means. This verb at the beginning of verse 7, behiza. So anyone familiar with biblical Hebrew knows that this is not a word we know in general. Hiza. So this idea of hazaya, sprinkling, it's not common, right? It only happens in the cult, and it happens with a couple of different places, and we're going to look at where we see it. So sprinkling seven times with the live bird, the cedar wood, the crimson stuff, and the hyssop that has been dipped in the blood of the bird that was slaughtered over fresh water, right? Then the other bird, I mean, then the bird that the priest is holding that just got dipped is sent off to fly free in the open country. The one to be purified shall wash those clothes, shave off all hair, and bathe in water, and then shall be pure. So there does have to be immersion, but sprinkling, hazaya, has to come first. Then they can bathe and will be pure. After that, the camp may be entered, but one must remain outside one's tent for 7 days. So the first of the purification ritual happens outside the camp, right? The big ritual happens by the high priest outside the camp. Then the person is able to come into the next stage, which is entering the camp, but they can't go into their home for another week. So they stay outside for 7 days. On the seventh day, again, they shave everything of their head. If they have a beard, eyebrows, everything. Once they shave off everything, the person again washes their clothes and bathes the body in water. Then they are tahor. On the eighth day, what happens? The person takes two male lambs without blemish, one ewe lamb in its first year without blemish, 3/10 of a measure of choice flour with oil mixed in for a meal offering, and 1 log of oil. These shall be presented before Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh with the party to be purified at the entrance of the Ohel Moed by the priest who performs the purification. So now the person is taking two animals and going to do something with them at the Ohel Moed. So we've gone from outside the camp, a ritual happens, then the person is able to come in but has to wait, and then goes through some stuff and can go into their home, then has to wait, and there's now a ritual that's going to happen so that the person can participate in the cult, right? That the person will be tahor enough to come into contact with the sancta, well, as far as Israelites are allowed to come into, right, the outside most wall of the sacred space. The priest shall take one of the male lambs and offer it with the log of oil as an asham, as a guilt offering, and shall elevate them as an elevation offering before Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. The lamb shall be slaughtered at the spot in the sacred area where the sin offering and the burnt offering are slaughtered, for the guilt offering, like the sin offering, goes to the priest. It is most holy. So it goes to the diagnoser, right, and the treater of the tum'ah, of the impurity. The priest shall take some of the blood of the guilt offering, and the priest shall put it on the ridge of the right ear of the one who's being purified, and on the thumb of the right hand, and on the big toe of the right foot. The priest shall then take some of the log of oil and pour it into the palm of his own left hand. And the priest shall dip his right finger in the oil that is in the palm of his left hand and sprinkle, here we're getting Hazayah again, some of the oil with his finger 7 times before Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Some of the oil left in his palm shall be put by the priest on the ridge of the right ear of the one being purified, on the thumb of the right hand, and on the big toe of the right foot, over the blood of the guilt offering. The rest of the oil in his palm the priest shall put on the head of the one being purified. Thus the priest shall make expiation for that person before God. The priest shall then offer the sin offering and make expiation for the one being purified of defilement. Last, the burnt offering shall be slaughtered. And the priest shall offer the burnt offering and the meal offering on the altar. The priest shall make expiation. We're getting this word chiper, kapara, yom kippur. Right? This is kaf pei hei. The person shall then be pure. If one is poor, we get like the way that they can do it with 2 turtle doves and 2 pigeons. On the eighth day, the person shall bring them to the priest at the entrance of the tent. The priest is going to offer them. And when the lamb has been slaughtered, the priest shall take some of the blood and put it, and here we get again, the ridge of the right ear, the thumb of the right hand, the toe of the big foot. Again, we get the pouring of the oil, putting it on the head of the person, what's left. Such is the ritual for one who has a scaly affection and whose means for purification are limited. And so now we're going to get the discussion of what happens for a house and a similar kind of business about how someone is. So everyone has to go out of the house, and then we're going to get the purification rituals for the house. So that the person can, and the family can move back into the house. All right. So what we have here is a very complicated set of rituals. We have a very non-self-explanatory set of very complicated rituals going on. right? This is not in any way intuitive. This is not like, oh, sure. Well, of course, immersion. Like, we, you know, mikveh is not that hard to get to. It's not that hard to comprehend. This is very complicated and is very intricate and clearly derives from some rituals that have been going on in the community for a long time, right? There are resonances here that we can feel. We don't get it all explained, right? So clearly something that they understood that we don't, right, anymore. It's a bit mysterious, but it's not unheard of. These rituals are not even unheard of to us if we've been studying Torah, right? Because we see a couple of familiar elements. We see this bird business, the hyssop. I mean, we see the hyssop, the crimson stuff, right? All that stuff. Where do we see that? So there's several terms that cue us into this being a special kind of ritual. We get hazaya, we get the sprinkling, and we get this. And there, and then there's discussion of this, the terms that we know a little bit about, but we really don't, like kapara, expiation. Right. So what does kapara really mean? And what, and is it always about sin? So there's lots of discussion in the literature that suggests kapara is not just about sin. It's about moving people from one state to another state. Rav Ezra Bick, this other person I was studying about, kapara says kapara is about moving a person to a state to be redeemed from a different state. But when the thing that has put one in that state that one needs to be redeemed from, I'm not on your sheet yet. I'm not on your paper. When one has been put in that position that one needs to be redeemed from by something really, really, really strong, you need something more than soap. Right? You need something more than immersion to fix it. And you need a different kind of process than the regular one that kapara usually suffices for. And so when it's a serious case, then we're getting this whole thing about how to move someone from a state they need to be redeemed from. And what Ezra Bick is going to argue is, there is something that's going on with the mitzvah that is unredeemable. This is why we have the bird that flies free. Because there's something that is not redeemable. So it is instead transferred and sent away. Because it can't be redeemed. Right? Where do we see this? Where else have you seen this? Where do you know this from? Putting it on the head of an animal and sending the animal off. Yes. Good, Harvey. We know this from the scapegoat. When is the scapegoat? When does all that happen? On what occasion? On Yom Kippur. Who does it? The high priest. It is exactly the same idea. There is something that seems that it is. I love this man. There is something that is unredeemable that has to be transferred onto the goat and carried off. An offering to do kapara is not enough. So it's assumed with the mitzvah that that's the case. There is something that is unredeemable and has to be carried off. And then the same is true of the sins of Israel that have to be transferred onto the head of the goat and sent off. So on your hard sheet that I gave you, those of you who are looking at it, we're going to go to this many staged ritual that we just read. So if you're looking at home, you'll see my pink highlighting shows up as gray. I don't know if you can see it. Great. If you can't, I'm going to use my cursor to show you where we are. All right. So a preliminary purification process, which takes place immediately upon the confirmation of his purity by the priest, is what we just read, happens first outside the camp. So the priest comes. Remember, the priest has been checking on the person, and the person has to keep waiting and waiting and waiting for the priest to come. The priest comes back and he may have to wait again. She may have to wait again. Wait again. Wait again. This can go on for weeks or months. Finally, the priest says the person is tahor of the tzara'at. The person is pure of the tzara'at. It has healed. Okay. That's when the ritual happens, when the ritual can start. And that starts right outside the camp. So Abravanel is, it's the commentator that, that he brings first, that, God Eldad brings first. The leper had to distance himself in two ways. First, from his people. Namely, he had to dwell alone outside the camp. Second, from God's sanctuary and resting place. Therefore, the person needs two purifications. The first, to make known that he was healthy and fit to re-enter the camp and to join with every member of the people. And the second purification, when he offered an offering before God that would atone for her, and then she could touch all holy things and enter the sanctuary. Right? So there's two levels, because the person was removed two levels, both from the community and from the sancta. And so there has to be two levels of coming back in. All right. So this ceremony, middle of that next paragraph, it's in your pink. This ceremony, I tried to make it easy for you all to follow. I did not have time to make a source sheet this week, so tried to make it easy for you to know where we're going. Good. Thank God. Something's easy. This ceremony is exceptional in character and unique to this event. The puzzling nature of the ceremony finds expression in the words of Abravanel. We're going to go to the end of that middle paragraph, which is his commentary. What then is the idea of these two birds if they were not brought as an offering? And what is the purpose of the slaughter if they were not brought as an offering? And what is the purpose of the living bird that is let go into the open field? Right. So you've killed one bird over water, but it's not an offering. And one bird is let go. So why do you bring two birds if you're not going to make a sacrifice with them? So already the commentators see what? Right. When you bring two animals, it's for an offering. That's not the case here. All right. What's going on? Well, Abravanel offers an answer. So do other commentators, of course. So let's look to the Torah itself, says God Eldad in this commentary, to see what we might learn from the parallels in Torah. So one, Ibn Ezra, medieval commentator, points to the similarity. We're at letter A. The similarity between the sprinkling of blood on the leper and the sprinkling of blood on one who became ritually impure through contact with a corpse. So we get hazayah, this sprinkling, we get it with the leper, and we get it from the communication of the next step down, the next highest step of impurity, which is corpse contamination, right? The leper, a leprous house, this is Ibn Ezra, the leper, a leprous house, and a person who become ritually impure through contact with a corpse are similar. They too being like the paschal offering brought in Egypt. Do you remember the paschal offering brought in Egypt? The paschal lamb. Yeah. Remember anything about hyssop? Remember anything about hyssop and blood? Very good. Go to your next pink place and kill the paschal lamb. We're getting Exodus, right? We're getting the commandment at Exodus. So you're on page 2, those of you in the room, the backside of your first page, pink. Kill the paschal lamb and you shall take a bunch of hyssop. Oh, look at that. And do what? Dip it in the blood that is in the basin and strike the lintel and the two side posts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of this house until the morning. This idea of hyssop, blood, right? Goes someplace. In this case, it's the outer ridges of the house. Where is it on the leper? Thumb, ear, and big toe. The outermost regions of the body. You put it on the outer regions of the house. You put it on the outer regions of the body, suggests some of our commentaries. That there is more things going on here that seem in common than we usually think about. Richard? Lovely. So that which comes into contact with the outer world, that door, not doorway, that portal between the outer and the inner, that's where Tzara'at erupted on the boundary between the person and the world, like my insides and the outside world. And that is where it's going to go on the house before redemption can happen. So notice, that's what I love about Ezra Bick's, you know, commentary, that this is about redemption. If it's a state of redemption that has to happen, and usually like there's ways to do that, that work, that kapara can do that, redeem one from a state to a different state, and that works. Just like in Egypt, it is the extreme case of needing to be redeemed. You need hyssop and blood and that stuff, right? To redeem the people from slavery to freedom. And you need the same thing for the mitzvah, to go from impure to pure. You need hyssop and blood. Yes. Yes. So it's a bunch. You're taking a bunch, right? And actually, when we toured with Renee, she took us, right, Bubby? You remember touring with Renee? She took my daughter and her beau at the time. Glad I didn't pay for his trip, since yes, that didn't last very much longer after Israel. She showed us hyssop, like on the hike. And she took a handful of it so she could show us like why it was hyssop, you know, that could work for this. And also, this is what she told us. And if you smell, if you do like this in your hands and smell it, it's very familiar. To me, it smelled like marinara sauce. And I'm like, what the heck? And like, yeah, I'm like, what? And, but I could not come up with like what it was, but it was very familiar. It smells like oregano. It is called, it's wild oregano. And it was also what was given to Jesus on the cross. So early Christians knew from sacrifice, blood and hyssop in order to affect what? Redemption. For them, what's redemption from? Sin. We don't have that. They reconstructed all of this, people. The early Christians, the Jesus followers, reconstructed all of this, including the concept of redemption. Jesus is on the cross as the sacrifice. His blood is spilled. There's got to be hyssop involved, because the blood, the hyssop, affects redemption.
Also the leper. Jesus cured the leper.
Right. Right. But in terms of tying it to our motif here of hyssop, it's not an accident. It's hyssop that's given to Jesus, right? And as his blood is being spilled, so it can affect redemption for humanity from sin. Okay? So that is a new concept, but it is based on our own rituals and understanding of what Bick is calling redemption. Yes.
The first use of the hyssop and the blood is in Exodus with the night of the death. Right?
Yes. This that we're looking at is the first use. Yes.
So doesn't that sort of imply that, you know, using those ingredients ritualistically means whatever is on the other side of that ritual is like scary bad. Well, in other words, you've got...
If you don't do it, you mean.
If you don't, right? So that means that in some ways, the you know, disfigurement to the body that leprosy causes, or the disfigurement to the house that the three or whatever it is causes.
Or the disfigurement of a free people who appear as slaves.
That can sort of like only be mediated through these specific things.
Correct. And I think to your point is what's on the other side of redemption is not necessarily scary bad. It's what's not supposed to be, right? You're not supposed to be separated from people, and you're not supposed to be separated from the sancta, and the Israelites are not supposed to be unfree.
Not meant to be.
They're not meant to be cut off from their purpose and their God. and they're being a holy nation. They're not supposed to be separated out into Egypt. They're cut off from the land of Israel. They're separated, right? And so it's the separation that needs to be fixed, because remember, we've talked about this before. If I have a 25%, a 25-cent coupon, what is the paper coupon worth? It's usually printed on the coupon. 0.04 of 1 cent, right? So the paper is worth nothing until it is what? Redeemed. When I redeem the coupon, I give the paper over, and what gets put in my hand? 25 cents, a quarter. That's what the paper is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a quarter, but it can't be a quarter until it's redeemed. The quarter is what it's always supposed to have been. That is the language here. The people Israel was always supposed to be free, but that can't happen till they're redeemed. Yes, George.
Excuse me, this reminds me of people in a prison or coming out of prison, coming out of a psychiatric hospital. And here, if you, is rehabilitation of some kind. But that the community also has to be prepared. And my question is the community prepared to take back this person?
The community in this set of rituals, I'm not going to talk about what you just said, added this layer of complication about our time and prison, because I think you're 100% right. In this situation, the priest takes care of the ritual. The people are not prepared. They don't have to be prepared. The person is coming back into regularity. They have been, they are coming out of COVID-19 quarantine. There's no problem. The people don't have to be prepared for someone who's been in quarantine for 14 days. They're fine, which is very, so as much as we want to go, ew, about this, really, the people bring them right back. What happens when you get somebody coming out of prison or coming out of a mental institution? Are they taken right back? No. Where's the ooh? Where does the ooh belong? Just saying. I just spoke to somebody who was sitting in my office yesterday who, because of circumstances that were tragic and whatever, he had to go to prison for a white collar crime because it was be part of not blowing the whistle, or his baby that was in ICU, he wouldn't have a job to keep paying the bills for his baby to be out of, you know, it got, would get to get kicked out of ICU. A choice I would never want to have to make. Goes to prison and then can't find a job. When he gets out of a white collar crime, can't get out of, can't find a job because no one will hire him to do what he knows how to do, right? Even at slinging burgers, they didn't want to hire him. And so he was homeless for 5 years. He's now successful and was discussing a gift that he wants to give to KI, because we've been there for him these last several years. He's been through a lot physically. And so my point is, it's very fresh for me, right? This story of what it means when we don't take them back. Violent criminals, I understand having a suspicion of, will they do it again? A white collar crime, and I'm not going to say where that line is. I'm just saying, when someone has paid their, has done their time, right? Do we do things to try to help make sure it doesn't happen again? Or do we say, we're not going to hire you, so you live on the street? What do you think the chance of recidivism is if they have no way to get what they need but steal it? Dana?
We don't have to answer this question now, but I'm thinking, what do we have in our Jewish tradition history to replace it? You no longer do it. That question keeps coming to mind because we feel so efficient having these traditions in place to help people move on and become pure.
We don't. Some people do mikvah, you know, if they want to, like, kind of express an understanding that they're shifting states. But to George's point, it's not the person often that's the issue. It's society. That, remember, didn't we talk about this last week? That, you know, if somebody stays home, they're considered eccentric and kind of quirky. If they're institutionalized for those very same things, they are now ostracized by, and they've done research on this. that they are then ostracized to a huge extent just because they were in a mental institution. The behavior is the exact same, right? But when they come home from that, they're shunned, right? That's the problem, is us. How do we help support, yes, the person who's coming back out of cancer treatment and is no longer a cancer patient? Like, how do you help those people feel like they're really leaving this whole thing behind? I think we are desperate for those kind of rituals. I also think, to George's really good point, we are terrible at figuring out how to communicate to a person, you are most welcome back here. How can we help support you continuing to live a life of normalcy and participation, full participation in the community? We're terrible at it.
What you just said, this is what you're saying to this particular person, and it makes sense, period. I mean, what happens after you say something like that? And I guess we have to obviously then follow up what we've mentioned, but how do you communicate is the whole idea.
Which idea?
That we're here for you.
Uh-huh. So that's a good question. That's a really good, I mean, I can do it. That's what I do. I spend a lot of my time doing that. And not just for people who are mentally ill, people who are physically ill. We've had people laying on their bed for months. We have two of them now, right? My job is to check in and say, we've not forgotten about you. You are still a full member of this community. We're thinking about you. Like, we miss you, you know. But I'm one person. I'm in a symbolic role. I understand that. And so I think it's really important that I do that. But I don't know how we do that. I think we need to be a lot better at it than we are.
Well, some families who would benefit from having a family member in a hospital will not do it because of the concern, either for their own, for themselves, for the patient when they come out.
Right. And that is the saddest thing ever, right? Is that people who resist having someone get the care they need because of the stigma that will attach either to them or to the person who's going in for treatment. It's a terrible thing that we ask people to choose. Right. All right. Who do I get to share? All right. Where are we? Thank you. Mark is keeping me honest. All right. Circle letter B, for those of you who are musicians.
Yes.
Right? Circle letter B. When we examine the Torah, we find another situation in which use is made of a pair of living creatures. And here we're getting the ritual, right, of the two goats, right, top of the next column. And he shall take the two goats, meaning Aaron, and set them before God at the door of the tent of meeting, which is exactly what's happening, right? You know, with this idea of setting them. And Aaron shall cast lots, because it means it's not about how they appear. It's not how they behave, right? It's just by lot. One is for God and one is for Azazel. And Aaron shall present the goat upon which the lot fell for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and offer it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell for Azazel shall be set alive before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to make atonement over it, to send it away for Azazel into the wilderness. I'm not going to go into that ritual. We can talk about that another time. I'm not going to talk about Azazel. Didn't I just say I'm not talking about Azazel? So
just wanted to
no, it's not hell. We don't have hell.
No, but I mean,
so people now use it to mean hell. We don't have hell, and no, it's not hell. That's what I will say about Azazel. All right. The two goats participate. We're at top of page 3. The two goats participate in the effort to achieve atonement for the holy place because of the impurities of the Israelites, similar to the two birds that serve to remove the impurity from the leper, right? So I already gave you my preview of that. Go to circle letter C. The initial conclusion that may be drawn from the comparison relates to the meaning of the sending away. The Torah goes into detail about the meaning of the sending of the way of the goat. Here it is from Torah. He shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the sins of the Israelites and their transgressions, even all their sins, and he shall put them upon the head of the goat and shall send it away by the hand of an appointed man into the wilderness, and the goat shall bear upon it all their iniquities to a land which is cut off, and he shall let go the goat in the wilderness. It should be emphasized that the Torah does not explicitly state that the goat is killed, but only that it is let go in the wilderness, just as the bird in the case of the leper is sent away in the open field. A comparison of the actions leads us to a conclusion that exposes a hidden aspect of the nature of leprosy. Even though we are all familiar with Chazal's assertion, which is our sage's assertion, that leprosy results from sin, nowhere is this explicitly stated in the Torah. Chazal presumably derived this from the manner by way of which a leper is purified, and from the fact that the sending away of the living bird comes to distance the leper's sins from himself. So Bick is talking about redemption. Our guy is talking about sin, distancing from sin.
So leper here is only used metaphorically as dysphoria, as not sin, but not belonging or being outside.
When you say here, where?
In this writing, I mean, are we talking about leprosy as a disease, or leprosy as metaphorically for being not going along with everything?
He's referencing the fact that because the same thing seems to be happening as when Aaron confesses the sins of the Israelites on the goat and sends it away, that the same thing's happening with the live bird. He's suggesting our sages say, so there must be a connection with the leper to sin, meaning there's some underlying sin or something that's happened to cause the leprosy. Because we're getting a similar ritual to the laying of Aaron's hands on the goat to transfer the sins of the Israelites onto the goat and set it out. The Chazal make that connection.
So does that suggest that the person who's afflicted is somehow guilty of bad behavior?
Yes, that's where Chazal go. Yes. Yes, that's where they connect these two rituals. Yes. And why does the person need kapara if there's no sin? Why do they need expiation? Why do they need to bring an asham if there's no sin? But if you'll recall, where else do we get an offering that is a sin offering with no evidence of there being a sin? Someone who's been in a state and is coming out of that state? Gold star for anybody who remembers. I'll give you a hint. Samson. Yes.
Samson and Goliath.
Yeah. If you're a Nazirite, if you take on the vows of becoming a Nazirite, when the Nazirite comes out of that time of being a Nazirite and is released from those vows, they bring a sin offering. So also coming out of childbirth purity, right? So there's lots of times there's a sin offering with no evidence of an actual sin, which is where Bick gets the idea that because maybe it's not the chatat, the expiation is not always about sin. It's about being redeemed from a state that one shouldn't stay in, which I love. I love this idea that expiation can be broader than just from sin. Sin puts you in that state that you need to be redeemed from, but so do some other things.
The vision of corpses. Being in the presence of a corpse, that's not sinful. It might be necessary.
It is necessary because we're commanded to bury our loved ones. So, but that's about tum'ah, right? That tum'ah can't be bad because you can't be commanded to do something bad. So that's the proof we use a lot to say tum'ah obviously doesn't mean bad because it's the highest thing you can do is take care of your loved one's remains, right?
So when a woman has to immerse herself in the mikveh for purification, it's not suggesting she did something sinful. It's just
no,
from one state to another.
Not at all. Correct. She's moving from dysregularity to regularity. She's now available to her husband. She's now in regular whatever. Menstruation removes one. And trust me, those of us who had, I'm past that thing. Those of us who had dysmenorrhea, it's for real. Like it puts you in a state of not being regular, right? And so it's just acknowledging what is, Jim. Jim?
Amy, are you, what I'm taking away, and you can either confirm this or, is that the redemption is what I wrote in the chat, that we have to be like the coupon, the paper for people to be, you know, to get to their redemption, whether it be a physical handicap, emotionally, you know, challenged or a handicap or spiritually. I mean, that's sort of my takeaway. Can you, is that what you were suggesting or?
You've just put a bunch of things in one category and I don't understand the connection between a physical handicap and whatever else you said. Why are those in a category together?
It's just being there for other people. That's what I'm getting at. Whatever challenges that they're experiencing in their lives, whether a physically, you know, emotionally or spiritually for that matter.
And so what are you asking about the paper?
We are the paper. It's like you do, you know, it's, you know, doing a mitzvah or doing something for somebody that, you know, is in a process of their own.
Okay.
You know,
I'm going to stop there and say, no, we are not the paper. The person is the paper. We are the cashier. Okay. We are the cashier. We say, I know you're not supposed to be paper. You're supposed to be a quarter. Here's a quarter. I see you for the value that I know you are and are supposed to be treated like a quarter, not like a piece of paper. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So in that tortured metaphor, I think we're the person standing behind the, you know, counter saying, will I recognize you as being worth 25 cents or are you only worth 0.004 of a penny? We get that opportunity all the time, mm-hmm. right? To help redeem. Yes. So in that sense, yes. If you want to say we're all cashiers, yes. All right. So let's look at circle letter D. The goat that is slaughtered serves to atone for and purify the holy place and the tent of meeting, right? We're talking about on the Day of Atonement because of their transgressions. And in this way, the Mishkan is purified from the sins that defiled it. Still, it stands to reason now that the sins that are removed from the Mishkan do not vanish into thin air, but are merely removed from the Mishkan. This is important. As such, they still threaten to return to the Mishkan. And therefore, the need arises to distance them. This is what the living goat does. The Torah relates that after the priest finishes atoning for the holy place by way of the confession for all their transgressions, even all their sins, the priest then loads the sins onto the head of the living goat, and it's sent far away into the wilderness. The pair of birds function in a manner similar to the model of the two goats. Go to the next pink place where that is. One of them parallels the sin offering goat that is slaughtered and cleanses the house of its impurity. The other one is dipped into the first one's blood and then carries the impurity away, distancing it from the house into the open field. Thus we reach the desired end. Quote, so he shall make atonement for the house and it shall be pure. So now we're talking obviously that this is part of the ritual, what's done to purify a house. So what did we just get added to the whole thing that makes this make a little more sense? You can remove the dross of sin from off of the Mishkan by transferring it onto the head of the, you know, he's slaughtered stuff. We've done some other stuff. Great. That removes, right, the dross of sin from off the Mishkan. But it's still floating around. You've dislodged it. If you dislodge a blood clot, okay, now I'm going to have a tortured analogy, Jim. You dislodge a blood clot and what happens? Sure. Or a piece of plaque from your heart. Sure, it's out of the heart. The plaque is out of the heart, but where else can it go? The brain. And then what happens? Yeah. Stroke, death. So, the same way that you've dislodged the ickiness from the Mishkan, you don't want that floating around, right? It can be drawn back. It's going to be drawn back to the Mishkan. You have to get rid of it. You have to actually, once a year, take all of it that's free-floating and send it away. It seems something similar is going on with the Mitzorah, that there's something so sticky about, right, the Tum'ah that's happening for the Mitzorah, that you dislodge it, but you need to do something with it to have it carried off. Or else it's kind of still free-floating and can, right, get stuck to stuff. So it'll be drawn to Sancta. So you have to put it on the live bird and send the live bird away. So two different explanations, Bick and a guy that I can't remember his last name. And so Eldad. So Eldad is saying it's not that it's unredeemable. It's that it's free-floating and now has to be distanced from, right, the Sancta. Mark likes that one. That, great, you did what you needed to do to dislodge it, but you don't want that floating around. It's so scary, like it's so powerful, you have to get rid of it. This is very much, I think, has to be informed by pagan ritual, magical stuff that lingers right in early Israel.
So try and tie a couple of things together.
Please do, Richard. Help me out here.
A few sessions ago, there was this whole thing that you didn't want to get into with word about Lashon Haron.
Correct.
Right? But to some extent, the sending off of the bird or the sending off of the goat, that's kind of like what we don't do with our formerly incarcerated people and our formerly institutionalized people. We continue the sentence by not sending something away. Not sending something away, that ickiness that sticks to things, that's the ickiness where gossip festers, where you have, that's the let's stay away from that house because that's the leper guy. And 3 years ago, all kinds of bad stuff happened, right? So if you don't send the things away, the community no longer really has permission to say bad things about the person who was redeemed.
No, if you do send things away, then they don't have permission.
Right. Don't send things away, then.
I love that. I love that. That gossip, Dafka, happens when we cling to the ickiness around a person's experience rather than say, okay, the person has done what they need to do and now we're going to banish that ickiness because then we don't get to talk about them. They're regular now, right? But if we don't do that, right, then the opportunity for gossip, oh yeah, you think he's so great? He's making a donation to the synagogue? Well, let me tell you what's in his past.
I just wonder if you can take it, maybe not in the Torah context, but in the contemporary context, like one step farther.
Let's do it. Let's see.
That, like, often people who struggle with mental illness or are incarcerated are because they are in a situation where they are already, like, catching the ickiness of the community. Like,
interesting.
They don't have housing or they aren't able to get a job for reasons that are, like, likely not their fault. And so they, in some ways, like, the way that the bird or the ram is sort of the, like, flypaper for the sins. They are also sort of like the flypaper for the sins of the community.
Interesting. So rather than it just being about what they did or who they are or what's wrong in the case of mental illness with them that takes them out of regularity, that it's our sinfulness on the early side of that that often, right, has that person remain in a state where they can't come back to regularity.
Right. And in the same way that, like, the bird or the goat is just getting picked because we're drawing lots, often the person is in that situation because they have just, like, been dealt a particular hand.
To begin with, that the genetic lot that fell on them was schizophrenia. That the lot that fell on them is a consumerist society where they are born into the bottom of the economic scale or ladder, and therefore the only hope they have going forward is to join a gang. I mean, I think it is a wonderful to start there and end up where Richard did, Right. So I see it as, yeah, one step further means one step earlier.
Right.
Right. One step earlier going to, so we start with your diagnosis of what's going on and end with Richard's, and all across that spectrum, the beginning and the ending, the problem is society. Not that there are episodic people doing things wrong or getting dealt a really bad hand this way or that way. And it's not that they don't go wrong or, but the real issue is that could be dealt with if we had a system that really cared about individuals the way I believe this ritual proves that they did. They cared deeply about not leaving someone out. And it's the high priest himself who is charged with bringing that person back in. Are you going to argue that the high priest's ritual didn't work? That's chutzpah. Who's going to do that? Who's going to say, oh, wait, we can't bring that person back? Not really, because, you know, we know about that high priest. We know about George. You know, the other high priest, maybe. But George, high priest, we don't buy it. Right? No one's going to do that, because then does anyone want that, right, on them, that they have gone against George as high priest? I don't think so. Yes.
I think a good example of integrating people that were, you know, got dealt a bad hand at birth or whatever into the mainstream is a program in Israel called Special in Uniform, which is run by JNF, Jewish National Fund, where they were young people with disabilities, they find a place for them in the army. So they serve in the IDF in whatever capacity they're able. And I mean, I just think it's a nice example of, you know, not keeping them separate and ostracized, but bringing them in to the mainstream.
I think that's beautiful. Because remember, in Israel, the IDF is not just a fighting force. The IDF is the socializing mechanism of Israel.
Yeah.
It is the great equalizer.
Yeah.
Because everybody comes in from different statuses, but they sit together in a tank. And so people meet somebody from Yemenite origin or a fairly observant person meets a secular Israeli, and they become part of a team. And sometimes it's the first time they've met someone outside of their own social context, right? And so it is the great socializer. And so it's beyond just, okay, you're going to be normal enough to serve in some sense in our fighting force. It's you are welcomed into that institution, which brings everybody in Israel into relationship with each other and into a core relationship with their Israeli identity.
So I think
you're part of, literally part of the team. Lisa.
Okay. I mean, what you said, so many gossip coming in, if you don't have a closing point, and it's so consistent with everything we've been reading in this section of Leviticus that we all thought was so weird and irrelevant. It's all about boundaries, and you have to create boundaries. There have to be ritual boundaries, or this liminal space allows for bad stuff to come in. And so this cutting off, this ritual that allows something to be cut off, this is the end, this person's okay, stops that ugliness from happening. You know, there's a boundary on both sides. And that's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing. It is a beautiful thing. Harvey?
I like the idea here that it's saying it's not easy to do this. You may have to go through all kinds of stuff, things that seem wacky, but, you know, it's not easy to create this purification and could be good within the community again.
It's not easy to bring people home.
Not easy. You got to go through a lot of stuff.
Yep. And are we willing to do it? And then the commentator, I'm not going to go through it, but talks about the person has had to spend a lot of time alone. The person's had to do a lot on their own. It's not without loneliness. It's not without isolation. It's not without an intense period of not belonging. It's not saying it's peachy keen, you know, no problem. We're just going to do all these things and it's fine. It's hard. Like the person has their own work to do. So Eldad is suggesting the person has their own work in isolation to do, with the hope, then the disappointment, the hope, then the disappointment. Maybe something will work. Maybe it won't. Right. And so like all of that, I want to close on 6 and then with a favorite reading of mine. Go down to that second paragraph on 6. Sorry, you've got my notes all over the place. Middle of that next paragraph, from the outside, the bird, right, that was dipped, appears to be wounded, but in truth, it is unharmed. At the end, it is released from the priest's grip, proving its ability to fly freely on its way. The bird confronts death, which leaves its imprint on it, but it survives, the bird being a reflection of the leper, him or herself. In light of the experience they've gained from the oppressive experience that they've undergone, they're fit to move forward to a renewed confrontation with those around them through this completion of purification. And rather than share the Torah quote here, I want to share, and I do this every year, and I was like, maybe I won't do it this year. And then I was like, yes, I'm going to. Tirzah Firestone writes this beautiful piece about mitzvah, meaning finding what's wrong. Mitzvah, finding the ra, finding what's wrong. We are all the mitzvah at one time or another. And so what happens, we have to literally go out of the machane, out of the mainstream. We are followed by the Kohen, who for so many of us is a teacher, a beloved shaman, a priest, a friend. And then talks about the rituals, right, that we go through, our shamanic rituals. The one that we have for coming back into the camp to bring our riches back into the machane has to do with two birds, a cedar branch, crimson wool, and hyssop, along with running water. Birds are a symbol of the soaring human spirit, the spirit that's alive within us. Notice that we take two. One is saved and one is killed. Why is that? The one that's killed has to do with that part of our spirit, which has to be exchanged, sacrificed, so that we can fly free. In order to soar, in order to really have mochin de gadlut, expanded consciousness, some part of us must be sacrificed. Each one of us knows this in our own personal lives, and we certainly know it as a people, as a nation. And after October 7th and its aftermath, I believe this reading stays as relevant as ever. On the way to being here now, renewing Judaism, we have suffered an incredible loss. One of our birds, the twin bird, has died, and on its wings come us. And having survived this loss, we know that we're never going to be the same. When we've come to consciousness, we know that we are inalterably changed by this sacrifice. Our twin soul, perhaps the innocence in us, or the people that we had to leave in order to be where we are now, is gone. We are marked. And so the Torah tells us in its deep wisdom that our wings are dipped in the blood of our twin soul. That blood is on our wings as we soar. But we do soar. And we're lifted off into the fields to fly free. Incredibly powerful for me every time. That is Rabbi Tirzah Firestone.
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.